Chrome Yellow by Aldous Huxley. Chapter 1. Along this particular stretch of line, no express had ever passed. All the trains, the few that there were, stopped at all the stations. Dennis knew the names of those stations by heart. Bull, Tritton, Spavin Delawarr, Nipswich for Timpany, West Bowlby, and finally, Camlet on the Water. Camlet was where he always got out, leaving the train to creep indolently onward, goodness only knew whither, into the green heart of England. They were snorting out of West Bowlby now. It was the next station, thank heaven. Dennis took his chattels off the rack and piled them neatly in the corner opposite his own. A futile proceeding, but one must have something to do. When he had finished, he sank back into his seat and closed his eyes. It was extremely hot. Oh, this journey! It was 2 hours cut clean out of his life, 2 hours in which he might have done so much, written the perfect poem, for example, or read the one illuminating book. Instead of which, his gorge rose at the smell of the dusty cushions against which he was leaning. 2 hours. 120 minutes. Anything might be done in that time. Anything. Nothing. Oh, he had had hundreds of hours, and what had he done with them? Wasted them. Spilt the precious minutes as though his reservoir were inexhaustible. Dennis groaned in the spirit, condemned himself utterly with all his works. What right had he to sit in the sunshine, to occupy corner seats in third-class carriages, to be alive? None. 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 Misery and a nameless nostalgic distress possessed him. He was 23, and oh, so agonizingly conscious of the fact. The train came bumpingly to a halt. Here was Camlet at last. Dennis jumped up, crammed his hat over his eyes, deranged his pile of baggage, leaned out of the window and shouted for a porter, seized a bag in either hand, and had to put them down again in order to open the door. When, at last, he had safely bundled himself and his baggage onto the platform, he ran up the train towards the van. "A bicycle! A bicycle!" he said breathlessly to the guard. He felt himself a man of action. The guard paid no attention, but continued methodically to hand out, one by one, the packages labelled to Camlet. "A bicycle!" Dennis repeated. "A green machine, cross-framed, name of Stone, S-T-O-N-E.
"All in good time, sir," said the guard soothingly.
He was a large, stately man with a naval beard. One pictured him at home, drinking tea, surrounded by a numerous family. It was in that tone that he must have spoken to his children when they were tiresome.
"All in good time, sir."
Dennis's man of action collapsed. Punctured. He left his luggage to be called for later and pushed off on his bicycle. He always took his bicycle when he went into the country. It was part of the theory of exercise. One day, one would get up at 6 o'clock and pedal away to Kenilworth or Stratford-on-Avon, anywhere. And within a radius of 20 miles, there were always Norman churches and Tudor mansions to be seen in the course of an afternoon's excursion. Somehow, they never did get seen, but all the same, it was nice to feel that the bicycle was there, and that one fine morning, one really might get up at 6. Once, at the top of the long hill which led up from Camlet Station, he felt his spirits mounting. The world, he found, was good. The faraway blue hills, the harvests whitening on the slopes of the ridge along which his road led him, the treeless skylines that changed as he moved, yes, they were all good. He was overcome by the beauty of those deeply embayed coombs, scooped in the flanks of the ridge beneath him. Curves, curves. He repeated the word slowly, trying as he did so to find some term in which to give expression to his appreciation. Curves. No, that was inadequate. He made a gesture with his hand, as though to scoop the achieved expression out of the air, and almost fell off his bicycle. What was the word to describe the curves of those little valleys? They were as fine as the lines of a human body. They were informed with the subtlety of art. Galbe. That was a good word, but it was French.
Le galbe évasé de ses anges. Had one ever read a French novel in which that phrase didn't occur? Some day he would compile a dictionary for the use of novelists. Galbe, gonflé, goulou, parfum, peu, pervers, potelé, pudeur, vertu, volupté. But he really must find that word. Curves, curves. Those little valleys had the lines of a cup moulded round a woman's breast. They seemed the dinted imprints of some huge divine body that had rested on these hills. Cumbrous locutions, these, but through them he seemed to be getting nearer to what he wanted. Dinted, dimpled, wimpled? His mind wandered down echoing corridors of assonance and alliteration ever further and further from the point. He was enamoured with the beauty of words. Becoming once more aware of the outer world, he found himself on the crest of a descent. The road plunged down, steep and straight, into a considerable valley. There, on the opposite slope, a little higher up the valley, stood Chrome, his destination. He put on his brakes. This view of Chrome was pleasant to linger over. The facade, with its three projecting towers, rose precipitously from among the dark trees of the garden. The house basked in full sunlight. The old brick rosily glowed. How ripe and rich it was! How superbly mellow! And at the same time, how austere! The hill was becoming steeper and steeper. He was gaining speed in spite of his brakes. He loosed his grip of the levers and in a moment was rushing headlong down. 5 minutes later, he was passing through the gate of the great courtyard. The front door stood hospitably open. He left his bicycle leaning against the wall and walked in. He would take them by surprise. Chapter 2. He took nobody by surprise. There was nobody to take. All was quiet. Dennis wandered from room to empty room, looking with pleasure at the familiar pictures and furniture, at all the little untidy signs of life that lay scattered here and there. He was rather glad that they were all out. It was amusing to wander through the house as though one were exploring a dead, deserted Pompeii. What sort of life would the excavator reconstruct from these remains? How would he people these empty chambers? There was the long gallery with its rows of respectable and, though, of course, one couldn't publicly admit it, rather boring Italian primitives, its Chinese sculptures, its unobtrusive, dateless furniture. There was the panelled drawing room where the huge, chintz-covered armchairs stood, oases of comfort among the austere, flesh-mortifying antiques. There was the morning room with its pale lemon walls, its painted Venetian chairs and rococo tables, its mirrors, its modern pictures. There was the library, cool, spacious, and dark, book-lined from floor to ceiling, rich in portentous folios. There was the dining room, solidly, port-winily English, with its great mahogany table, its 18th-century chairs and sideboard, its 18th-century pictures, family portraits, meticulous animal paintings. What could one reconstruct from such data? There was much of Henry Wimbush in the long gallery in the library, something of Anne, perhaps, in the morning room. That was all. Among the accumulations of 10 generations, the living had left but few traces. Lying on the table in the morning room, he saw his own book of poems. What tact! He picked it up and opened it. It was what the reviewers call a slim volume. He read at hazard, but silence and the topless dark vault in the lights of Luna Park, and Blackpool from the nightly gloom hollows a bright, tumultuous tomb. He put it down again, shook his head, and sighed. What genius I had then, he reflected, echoing the aged Swift. It was nearly 6 months since the book had been published. He was glad to think he would never write anything of the same sort again. Who could have been reading it, he wondered. Anne, perhaps? He liked to think so. Perhaps, too, she had at last recognized herself in the hamadryad of the popular sapling, the slim hamadryad whose movements were like the swaying of a young tree in the wind. The woman who was a tree was what he called the poem.
He had given her the book when it came out, hoping that the poem would tell her what he hadn't dared to say. She had never referred to it. He shut his eyes and saw a vision of her in a red velvet cloak, swaying into the little restaurant where they sometimes dined together in London, 3/4 of an hour late, and he at his table, haggard with anxiety, irritation, hunger. Oh, she was damnable. It occurred to him that perhaps his hostess might be in her boudoir. It was a possibility. He would go and see. Mrs. Wimbush's boudoir was in the central tower on the garden front. A little staircase corkscrewed up to it from the hall. Dennis mounted, tapped at the door.
Come in.
Ah, she was there. He'd rather hoped she wouldn't be. He opened the door. Priscilla Wimbush was lying on the sofa. A blotting pad rested on her knees, and she was thoughtfully sucking the end of a silver pencil.
Hello,
she said, looking up.
I'd forgotten you were coming.
Well, here I am, I'm afraid, said Dennis deprecatingly. I'm awfully sorry. Mrs. Wimbush laughed. Her voice, her laughter, were deep and masculine. Everything about her was manly. She had a large, square, middle-aged face with a massive projecting nose and little greenish eyes, the whole surmounted by a lofty and elaborate coiffure of a curiously improbable shade of orange. Looking at her, Dennis always thought of Wilkie Bard as the cantatrice. That's why I'm going to sing in opera, sing in opera, sing in op-op-op-op-opera. Today, she was wearing a purple silk dress with a high collar and a row of pearls. The costume, so richly dowagerish, so suggestive of the royal family, made her look more than ever like something on the halls.
What have you been doing all this time? She asked.
Well, said Dennis, and he hesitated, almost voluptuously. He had a tremendously amusing account of London and its doings, all ripe and ready in his mind. It would be a pleasure to give it utterance. To begin with, he said, but he was too late. Mrs. Wimbush's question had been what the grammarians call rhetorical. It asked for no answer. It was a little conversational flourish, a gambit in the polite game.
You find me busy at my horoscopes,
she said, without even being aware that she had interrupted him. A little pained, Dennis decided to reserve his story for more receptive ears. He contented himself, by way of revenge, with saying, "Oh," rather icily.
"Did I tell you how I won 400 on the Grand National this year?"
"Yes," he replied, still frigid and monosyllabic. She must have told him at least 6 times.
"Wonderful, isn't it? Everything is in the stars. In the old days, before I had the stars to help me, I used to lose thousands. Now..."
She paused an instant.
"Well, look at that 400 on the Grand National. That's the stars."
Dennis would have liked to hear more about the old days, but he was too discreet and still more too shy to ask. There had been something of a bust-up, that was all he knew. Old Priscilla, not so old then, of course, and sprightlier, had lost a great deal of money, dropped it in handfuls and hatfuls on every racecourse in the country. She had gambled, too. The number of thousands varied in the different legends, but all put it high. Henry Wimbush was forced to sell some of his primitives, a Taddeo de Poggibonsi, an Amico di Taddeo, and 4 or 5 nameless Sienese, to the Americans. There was a crisis. For the first time in his life, Henry asserted himself, and with good effect, it seemed. Priscilla's gay and gadding existence had come to an abrupt end. Nowadays, she spent almost all her time at Crome, cultivating a rather ill-defined malady. For consolation, she dallied with New Thought and the occult. Her passion for racing still possessed her, and Henry, who was a kind-hearted fellow at bottom, allowed her £40 a month betting money. Most of Priscilla's days were spent in casting the horoscopes of horses, and she invested her money scientifically, as the stars dictated. She betted on football, too, and had a large notebook in which she registered the horoscopes of all the players in all the teams of the league. The process of balancing the horoscopes of 2 elevens, one against the other, was a very delicate and difficult one. A match between the Spurs and the Villa entailed a conflict in the heavens so vast and so complicated that it was not to be wondered at if she sometimes made a mistake about the outcome.
"Such a pity you don't believe in these things, Dennis. Such a pity,"
said Mrs. Wimbush in her deep, distinct voice. "I can't say I feel it so."
"Ah, that's because you don't know what it's like to have faith. You have no idea how amusing and exciting life becomes when you do believe. All that happens means something. Nothing you do is ever insignificant. It makes life so jolly, you know. Here am I at Crome, dull as ditch water, you'd think, but no, I don't find it so. I don't regret the old days a bit. I have the stars."
She picked up the sheet of paper that was lying on the blotting pad.
"Inman's horoscope,"
she explained.
"I thought I'd like to have a little fling on the billiards championship this autumn. I have the infinite to keep in tune with."
She waved her hand.
"And then there's the next world and all the spirits, and one's aura, and Mrs. Eddy, and saying you're not ill, and the Christian mysteries, and Mrs. Besant. It's all splendid. One's never dull for a moment. I can't think how I used to get on before, in the old days. Pleasure? Running about, that's all it was. Just running about. Lunch, tea, dinner, theatre, supper, every day. It was fun, of course, while it lasted, but there wasn't much left of it afterwards. There's a rather good thing about that in Barbecue Smith's new book. Where is it?"
She sat up and reached for a book that was lying on the little table by the head of the sofa.
"Do you know him, by the way?"
she asked.
"Who?" "Mr. Barbecue Smith."
Dennis knew of him vaguely. Barbecue Smith was a name in the Sunday papers. He wrote about the conduct of life. He might even be the author of What a Young Girl Ought to Know. "No, not personally," he said.
"I've invited him for next weekend."
She turned over the pages of the book.
"Here's the passage I was thinking of. I marked it. I always mark the things I like."
Holding the book almost at arm's length, for she was somewhat long-sighted, and making suitable gestures with her free hand, she began to read slowly, dramatically.
"What are 1,000-pound fur coats? What are 250,000 incomes?"
She looked up from the page with a histrionic movement of the head. Her orange coiffure nodded portentously. Dennis looked at it, fascinated.
Was it the real thing and henna, he wondered, or was it one of those complete transformations one sees in the advertisements? "What are thrones and scepters?"
The orange transformation. Yes, it must be a transformation, bobbed up again.
"What are the gaieties of the rich, the splendours of the powerful? What is the pride of the great? What are the gaudy pleasures of high society?"
The voice, which had risen in tone questioningly from sentence to sentence, dropped suddenly and boomed reply.
"They are nothing. Vanity, fluff, dandelion seed in the wind, thin vapours of fever. The things that matter happen in the heart. Seen things are sweet, but those unseen are 1,000 times more significant. It is the unseen that counts in life."
Mrs. Wimbush lowered the book.
"Beautiful, isn't it?"
she said. Dennis preferred not to hazard an opinion, but uttered a noncommittal,
"Ah, it's a fine book, this, a beautiful book," said Priscilla,
as she let the pages flick back one by one from under her thumb.
"And here's the passage about the lotus pool. He compares the soul to a lotus pool, you know."
She held up the book again and read.
"A friend of mine has a lotus pool in his garden. It lies in a little dell embowered with wild roses and eglantine, among which the nightingale pours forth its amorous descant all the summer long. Within the pool, the lotuses blossom, and the birds of the air come to drink and bathe themselves in its crystal waters."
"Ah, and that reminds me,"
Priscilla exclaimed, shutting the book with a clap and uttering her big, profound laugh.
"That reminds me of the things that have been going on in our bathing pool since you were here last. We gave the village people leave to come and bathe here in the evenings. You've no idea of the things that happened."
She leaned forward, speaking in a confidential whisper. Every now and then she uttered a deep gurgle of laughter.
"Mixed bathing? Saw them out of my window. Sent for a pair of field glasses to make sure.
No doubt of it.
The laughter broke out again. Dennis laughed too. Barbecue Smith was tossed on the floor.
It's time we went to see if tea's ready, said Priscilla.
She hoisted herself up from the sofa and went swishing off across the room, striding beneath the trailing silk. Dennis followed her, faintly humming to himself. That's why I'm going to sing in opera, sing in opera, sing in op-pop-pop-pop-opera. And then the little twiddly bit of accompaniment at the end. Rrrr. Chapter 3. The terrace in front of the house was a long, narrow strip of turf, bounded along its outer edge by a graceful stone balustrade. Two little summer houses of brick stood at either end. Below the house, the ground sloped very steeply away, and the terrace was a remarkably high one. From the balusters to the sloping lawn beneath was a drop of 30 feet. Seen from below, the high, unbroken terrace wall, built like the house itself of brick, had the almost menacing aspect of a fortification, a castle bastion, from whose parapet one looked out across airy depths to distances level with the eye. Below, in the foreground, hedged in by solid masses of sculptured yew trees, lay the stone-brimmed swimming pool. Beyond it stretched the park with its massive elms, its green expanses of grass, and at the bottom of the valley the gleam of the narrow river. On the farther side of the stream, the land rose again in a long slope, checkered with cultivation. Looking up the valley to the right, one saw a line of blue, far-off hills. The tea-table had been planted in the shade of one of the little summer-houses, and the rest of the party was already assembled about it when Dennis and Priscilla made their appearance. Henry Wimbush had begun to pour out the tea. He was one of those ageless, unchanging men on the farther side of 50, who might be 30, who might be anything. Dennis had known him almost as long as he could remember. In all those years, his pale, rather handsome face had never grown any older. It was like the pale grey bowler hat which he always wore, winter and summer, unaging, calm, serenely without expression. Next him, but separated from him and from the rest of the world by the almost impenetrable barriers of her deafness, sat Jenny Mullion. She was perhaps 30, had a tilted nose and a pink and white complexion, and wore her brown hair plaited and coiled in two lateral buns over her ears. In the secret tower of her deafness, she sat apart, looking down at the world through sharply piercing eyes. What did she think of men and women and things? That was something that Dennis had never been able to discover. In her enigmatic remoteness, Jenny was a little disquieting. Even now, some interior joke seemed to be amusing her, for she was smiling to herself, and her brown eyes were like very bright round marbles. On his other side, the serious, moon-like innocence of Mary Bracegirdle's face shone pink and childish. She was nearly 23, but one wouldn't have guessed it. Her short hair, clipped like a page's, hung in a bell of elastic gold about her cheeks. She had large blue china eyes, whose expression was one of ingenuous and often puzzled earnestness. Next to Mary, a small gaunt man was sitting, rigid and erect in his chair. In appearance, Mr. Scogan was like one of those extinct bird lizards of the tertiary. His nose was beaked, his dark eye had the shining quickness of a robin's, but there was nothing soft or gracious or feathery about him. The skin of his wrinkled brown face had a dry and scaly look. His hands were the hands of a crocodile. His movements were marked by the lizard's disconcertingly abrupt clockwork speed. His speech was thin, fluty, and dry. Henry Wimbush's schoolfellow and exact contemporary, Mr. Scogan looked far older and at the same time far more youthfully alive than did that gentle aristocrat with the face like a grey bowler. Mr. Scogan might look like an extinct saurian, but Gombauld was altogether and essentially human. In the old-fashioned natural histories of the 30s, he might have figured in a steel engraving as a type of Homo sapiens, an honour which at that time commonly fell to Lord Byron.
Indeed, with more hair and less collar, Gombauld would have been completely Byronic, more than Byronic even, for Gombauld was of Provençal descent, a black-haired young corsair of 30, with flashing teeth and luminous large dark eyes. Dennis looked at him enviously. He was jealous of his talent. If only he wrote verse as well as Gombauld painted pictures. Still more, at the moment, he envied Gombauld his looks, his vitality, his easy confidence of manner. Was it surprising that Anne should like him? Like him? It might even be something worse, Dennis reflected bitterly, as he walked at Priscilla's side down the long grass terrace. Between Gombauld and Mr. Scogan, a very much lowered deck chair presented its back to the new arrivals as they advanced towards the tea-table. Gombauld was leaning over it. His face moved vivaciously. He smiled, he laughed, he made quick gestures with his hands. From the depths of the chair came up a sound of soft, lazy laughter. Dennis started as he heard it. That laughter. How well he knew it. What emotions it evoked in him. He quickened his pace. In her low deck chair, Anne was nearer to lying than to sitting. Her long, slender body reposed in an attitude of listless and indolent grace. Within its setting of light brown hair, her face had a pretty regularity that was almost doll-like. And indeed, there were moments when she seemed nothing more than a doll, when the oval face with its long-lashed pale blue eyes expressed nothing, when it was no more than a lazy mask of wax. She was Henry Wimbush's own niece. That bowler-like countenance was one of the Wimbush heirlooms. It ran in the family, appearing in its female members as a blank doll face. But across this dollish mask, like a gay melody dancing over an unchanging fundamental bass, passed Anne's other inheritance, quick laughter, light ironic amusement, and the changing expressions of many moods. She was smiling now as Dennis looked down at her. Her cat smile, he called it, for no very good reason. The mouth was compressed, and on either side of it, two tiny wrinkles had formed themselves in her cheeks. An infinity of slightly malicious amusement lurked in those little folds, in the puckers about the half-closed eyes, in the eyes themselves, bright and laughing between the narrowed lids. The preliminary greeting spoken, Dennis found an empty chair between Gombauld and Jenny, and sat down. "How are you, Jenny?" he shouted at her. Jenny nodded and smiled in mysterious silence, as though the subject of her health were a secret that could not be publicly divulged. "How's London been since I went away?" Anne inquired from the depth of her chair. The moment had come. The tremendously amusing narrative was waiting for utterance.
"Well," said Dennis, smiling happily, "to begin with, has Priscilla told you of our great antiquarian find?"
Henry Wimbush leaned forward. The most promising of buds was nipped.
"To begin with," said Dennis desperately, "there was the ballet."
"Last week," Mr. Wimbush went on softly and implacably, "we dug up 50 yards of oaken drainpipes, just tree trunks with a hole bored through the middle. Very interesting indeed. Whether they were laid down by the monks in the 15th century, or whether—"
Dennis listened gloomily.
"Extraordinary," he said, when Mr. Wimbush had finished.
"Quite extraordinary." He helped himself to another slice of cake. He didn't even want to tell his tale about London now. He was damped. End of side 1.